Welcome to the Water Entrepreneur Podcast. This program features a series of interviews exploring the origin stories of startup founders, early adopters, and innovation champions related to their personal, technical, business, organizational, and financial journeys. This podcast is sponsored by Astera, the leader in remote Earth observation technology for the water business. Support is also supplied by Imagine H2O, envisioning and building solutions with the world's best water entrepreneurs. And now, live from beautiful downtown Encinitas, your host, Paul Gagliardo. Welcome and thanks for joining me today. This is episode 12 of the Water Entrepreneur Podcast, and I'm your host, Paul Gagliardo. And today, I have as my guest, Anthea Sargent, co-founder and CEO of 2S Water, protecting the world's water with real-time data using single and multi-element sensors for metal detection. Hi, Anthea. Thanks for being a water entrepreneur and appearing on the show.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're my first Canadian guest. I was thinking today I've interviewed people from all around the world, and now we can put a little pin in the Canadian country spot there. So I'm gonna have to get a little map for my wall.
Well, awesome to represent Canada. I'll do my best.
So I see by your CV that you were born to be an entrepreneur. You started a company when you're still in high school catering to felines. And you worked with your father and grandfather in a family business, and then you started 2S Water. Tell me, what's in your DNA that makes you a serial startup founder?
That's a good question. And if you can figure out the answer, please let me know. I'm sure at least some of it had to do with entrepreneurial people around me. As you mentioned, I worked with my father and my grandfather. They were both entrepreneurs. My father's a 10X entrepreneur. My grandfather always worked for himself his entire career. My husband as well is very, very entrepreneurial. And that first business that we had that put me through university, my husband and I did together. It's a lot of fun. And I think that's what keeps me coming back to entrepreneurial activities.
And you don't find it overly stressful? I know a lot of people, including myself, always liked the comfort of working for a company, even though it's a love-hate relationship. And I tried to do creative things within that structure. It took me quite a while before I was comfortable enough moving out on my own and, having nobody else to rely on, to be the breadwinner. So do you find any stress in that at all?
Oh, I definitely find stress in it. I mean, you can't not find stress in it. When I got into 2S Water, I started to really dig into like a lot of the entrepreneurial, material out there. One of the first things they said was know yourself. And I went back and I reviewed my life and I realized I had this chronic pattern of picking really difficult things. Once I realized that, I suddenly realized why I thrive so much in this environment and why I didn't thrive when I was working in a more structured business environment. Yes, it's very stressful, but apparently that's what I live for. And now I just embrace it.
That's great. My dad always worked for himself. He always had his own businesses, ever since I can remember growing up. But I think he couched his bets because he also taught school at the same time. So he would go into the office in the morning, set up he was an architect. Set up to work for his guys. Then he'd go teach school. He'd come back at lunchtime and he'd go back. It's like, man, that's dead. Relax. You don't need two full-time jobs. But I guess that was the way he managed, the steady income part of life.
I think he did well with his architecture business, but he never just went to do that until he was about 70, and then he just said, "Okay, I'm done teaching school. I'm just going to play architect now."
He was finally ready to start his career at 70.
That's right. Hey, I'm 67. I follow my
anytime now then. Yeah.
That's right. It's almost ready to go.
Well, I will tell you, my grandfather worked until 96.
Wow.
And they do say after a certain point, the survival rate increases if you're still working, because you have drive and you have something to wake up for to do in the morning.
My wife has a family farm in the Central Valley in California near Fresno, and her mom will be 101 on Thanksgiving, U.S. Thanksgiving, and she still signs the checks. She still reads the farm magazines. There's three daughters and her, the four of them. She's still, kind of active in the business. And so you're absolutely right. Without the farm, I think, she wouldn't have anything to live for. So let's hope both you and I make it that long, right?
Well, I think it's just a testament to your work having to be more than a job. You have to love what you're doing because you're never going to keep going if you don't. And the attitude that I learned from my father's family, which was that you don't retire, you do what you love and you just keep doing it because why would you possibly stop? I think that is how I would like to live my life. I'll see how that turns out when I grow up one day. But until then, that's the plan.
Never grow up. So your background was, I guess, business administration, and now with 2S Water, it's a really much more of a focus on technical issues, I guess, more than administrative issues. How did you make that transition?
Well, I think I've always been a jack of all trades of business. That's I've worked in a lot of different departments. I mean, part of the advantage of the family business is that I got to run through everything. I started at the reception desk. I worked in accounting. I did, budgeting, forecasting. I did HR. I did sales and marketing. And it was just because, a position would open up and I would be granted the trust to go and learn it and do it, which I would not have had in a more traditional business. And I'm eternally grateful for that. And it's been a huge advantage in a startup. I didn't realize I was training to do a startup, but it's given me a good basis in all the different silos of business. I actually thought, a jack of all trades, master of none, that's a disadvantage, but it's turned out this is the one place where it really is advantageous. And I do well with it because I love it. I mean, business is a discipline just like any science. A little less scientific. It's in its application, unfortunately. There's not you can't get that kind of great data that you get in the raw sciences. But it is a discipline worthy of study and really truly innovative and interesting things can be done in that. And I think living in a startup is one of the few places I get to experience every single part of a business and truly understand it in its entirety.
So when you started 2S Water, how did that come about, that just the idea of that business model or that service? Where did that come from?
It had a different starting point than most businesses. What happened was one day I walked into my father's office and said, I think we should start our own business. And we sat down between the two of us and identified what we wanted that business to look like. My requirement was I wanted it to be an environmentally driven business. My family is in the oil and gas industry here in Alberta. Everyone is in the oil and gas industry. It's much like Texas in that fashion. Whereas I was deeply honored to be supporting the family business and supporting my grandfather and my grandmother that way, I didn't feel like I was leaving the environmental legacy that I wanted to leave. That was my requirement. My father's requirement was monthly recurring revenue because it takes two types to run a business. So we went looking for a problem, and we were aware of the problem in water from our experience in the oil and gas industry. It was around the time we were seeing major disruptions in Flint, Michigan, major disruptions in the water supply of many municipalities. So we immediately saw there was at least two markets that were suffering from this issue. Then we started reading scientific papers until we found somebody doing this in the lab in a way that we thought we could commercialize into a real product. And we took it to the local university and partnered with them in order to develop it to the point that we could commercialize it. So it's a bit of a different path. We actually went and found the problem first and then found a solution. It doesn't always work. You know, that commercialization stage of a paper is very, very difficult. Certainly we went into it being like, oh, this is going to be a cinch. We have the paper. We'll just build the machine. Off we go. 2 years later, we got to something that was viable. So it's not the easiest path. It wasn't a quick cinch, but we started with that product market fit and moved backwards from there.
Interesting, because some of the people I talk to start with an invention and they look for a solution. And then you are just, you know, the opposite. You look for a problem and then you look for something, you know, for a solution to kind of cater to that problem. So, it's, you know, it's an interesting duality about how people go about kind of deciding what their business is going to be. Do you have a proprietary or, you know, testing protocols, or do you take off the shelf equipment, or, you know, how does that, explain to me a little bit about the product?
Yeah. So, because we started out with a scientific paper, one of our first concerns was we weren't going to have a lot of IP because it had already been published. The core technology that we use was actually first patented in 1868. So as you might have suspected, that patent has expired now. however, that wasn't a market viable invention. So we put a lot of work and effort into increasing the detection limits on that original concept. So we've 100x the detection limits from where that original concept began, which has made it a market viable. So to our surprise, our happy surprise, we do have a fair bit of patent protected IP around our plasma generation core. Now, a lot of the peripherals that we use are off the shelf, and they're assembled in an innovative fashion, and they're automated in an innovative fashion. But we really wanted to focus on our core competency, which was this plasma that we generate, not on the peripherals, which bring value, but didn't bring value to our shareholders in the kind of way that we should be inventing them from scratch. You know, we wanted to stand on the shoulders of giants on this one, and I think we did a very good job of that.
Interesting. And so the technology is it totally geared towards metals?
Yeah. So we actually heat the water into a plasma, and then we see what light emits from that, which is a well-known methodology. We generate that plasma in a unique way. But that means that any kind of complicated molecule, we blow apart in process. So if you tell me there's organics in the water, I'm going to tell you, yes, I saw carbon. Like, we don't keep those together.
So this may be a little off topic, but I had talked to somebody when I was at American Water, probably in 2012 or so, and he was pitching me on something, I'll say similar, but he was touting it as quantum chemistry. And I think he was in kind of in your area, and he was looking at uranium and the oil and gas business. I mean, I can't remember the guy's name, but I mean, are you pitching me on quantum chemistry technology or what?
Well, now take this with a grain of salt, because I have already said I'm on the business side. I hire no very smart scientists. However, they have often reined me in from using terms I shouldn't be using, and I have never been authorized to use quantum. So I don't think that applies.
Okay. Just checking. I was doing a little bit of, scrolling around and trying to... Because somebody just won a Nobel Prize looking at entanglement and spooky attraction at a distance. And so I was looking up quantum mechanics again, because I've read books on it. And so for some reason, quantum mechanics was on my mind. So I figured I needed to
If you to can ask. Create a sensor that uses quantum entanglement to detect the qualities of water, then give me a call and we'll work on that.
Okay, you'll be the first one I'll call. So what kind of things did you learn from, you know, your father and your grandfather a generation ago, two generations ago, you know, just from the business perspective? Were there lessons that they learned, you know, 50, 60 years ago that you can apply now? Or have things changed so much that, you know, they're just quaint historical artifacts?
I think a bit of both. And I think even learning the ones that you could call quaint historical artifacts has had a lot of value as well. I'm a big believer in understanding the history of a thing to properly understand that thing. And the history of business is not, you know, in its current format, isn't that long. And you could probably argue that my grandfather was there near the inception of the modern business, you know, methodologies that we have right now. I certainly learned a lot about how to properly run a business, about, you know, one of the things I often see is, you know, improper bookkeeping in young startups. You know, things like that were never allowed where I learned my business basics. You know, we did things right, and that has benefited me greatly. On the other hand, the way that we handled how we dealt with our employees, you know, 100 years ago and how we deal with them now is vastly, vastly different. I think that's one of the places where my grandfather and I butted heads most often is, you know, he had a very structured idea of how you interact with employees, about how employees are to be managed. And we have moved a vast ways away from there now. But learning how it was done before allowed me to know how I wanted to run my company. So it's all valuable learning, I think.
Sure. It's almost better. I find it more, sometimes more valuable to learn the failed lessons or, you know, learn. I used to tell my staff all the time, look, give me bad news first. Good news can wait. You know, that's fine. Give me the bad news. And it's kind of the same with this is, you know, if you learn those kind of failed practices, you could say, okay, great, got that. Let's go this way, you know, and it's something you can actively stay away from.
I think that's such an important lesson too, because so often, especially in business, all we get are the examples of successes. We don't sit down, and I mean, a bit more in the startup world, because there is that kind of embracing of the failure mentality. But certainly when I look at the, you know, inspirational business cases, it's always a raft of people who've done vastly successful. You know, I'm not learning as much from that unless I also have the comparative of what went wrong.
Yeah.
Because you just don't know if it's a statistical aberration or if it's an actual trend that you need to learn and understand.
How many people do you have in the company now?
We're a huge team of six.
Six, okay, almost. I was hoping for double digits.
We're getting there.
So do you have the product? What do you call the machine?
We call it the AquaValid sensor.
AquaValid, okay. And you also have a backhauling mechanism and software and dashboard and all that kind of stuff too?
Yes. Yeah. Just displaying our data right now. I think, you know, when it comes to building out a big analytics data platform, we're going to partner with somebody. There's so many people working on innovations right now that I really believe you have to focus on your core competency and not bring in any of that extra peripherals. That's how you create the most value.
I would tend to agree with you. I've worked with water meter manufacturers, and I would always tell them, look, make the meter. Don't give me software, you know, that are meter manufacturers making. It's never going to be any good. And they're like, oh no, it's the greatest software in the world. It's like, yeah, fine. Okay, great. So I absolutely agree with you. So when you're marketing to, I guess, industrial commercial clients, what's your value proposition to them? What are they getting out of this? I guess it's close to real-time monitoring of metals.
Yeah, and we're really focused on the industrial market right now. And primarily within the industrial market, the mining industry. Having said that, you know, any water treatment facility that has metals running through it is a potential user of our product. So there's a vast variety. And the main and most important application that we're looking at is effluent monitoring. So is the water coming out of your water treatment facility safe and ready to go into the environment, ready for human consumption? Or does it need to be diverted for additional treatment, put into a tailings pond? You know, if we can increase the safety of the water going to the environment, if we can decrease the amount of tailings by reprocessing more water and recycling more water, then we're a success. Now, the fun part about the mining industry is they're also doing extractive processes, and most extractive processes go through an aqueous phase. So if we look at things like lithium brine, you know, more than half of the lithium in the world is extracted from a dissolved state mm-hmm. in a brine.
Right.
So one of the things we're doing a fair bit of is lithium brine monitoring. So figuring out the concentration of those brines as they come out of the ground so that we can properly extract it. Same with gold cyanide, where you melt the gold into a cyanide base. Now the question is, how much of that fluid is gold and how much is cyanide? And am I getting all the gold out? So really interesting in-process applications where we can help reduce the environmental impact on a per ton basis of the metals that are produced in this world.
So you can use it on the front end as well as the back end.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. All throughout the process, anytime things go aqueous, there's potential applications for our sensor.
Interesting. I wanted to ask about the fundraising side of things. And you know, that is always a fascinating sidelight to the business process.
Yes.
And it's very different. You know, you gotta put on your fancy suit, you know, and get all dressed up and, you know, go meet, you know, the people with the money, right? And try to talk them into giving you some at reasonable conditions. So how did you, how was that process for you?
Well, I think you're totally right. Like, it is a very, very different process. It's basically a sales process, but you're selling something you don't actually want to sell, which is a very strange journey to go through. Having said that, we did successfully fundraise. I'm very pleased with that. You know, it's a huge honor to have other people put money into your company and put faith in you and support you in that way. The process was difficult. Shall I say difficult? Is that the word I'm looking for?
You know, this is not a family show. You can use whatever
word you want. Well, at the risk of having a long bleep right here, it was, we'll stick with difficult.
So did you have to look for VCs or private equity firms that had the niche that would invest, whether it was water or whether it was oil and gas or whether it was, you know, technology or early stage? I mean, there's so many niches that, you know, these funding organizations have. I mean, I have a laundry list of probably 200 or 300 funding organizations, and next to each one of them is, I have a little code. It's like, oh yeah, early stage, very early stage, growth stage, you know, impact investors. It's like, I don't even know what these words mean, but, you know, that's how they describe themselves, right? So did you have a hard time even finding the right people to talk to?
When we started out, we did, for sure. I think we learned to really narrow it down. Firstly, you know, when you're playing in hardware, that's a whole different game than software.
Yes.
So obviously that's 75% of the investors off the table right there, because software's, I think it's more popular right now. Where we ended up finding our investment and getting the offers that we got were all people who understood the water industry. Water isn't the same as other industries. The cycle of it, the timing of it, you know, the market, very, very different. And while other investors were interested, it was in the water market investors where we got enough fit that they actually understood and aligned with the path of the company. you know, an offer is an agreement between you and an investor that you're going to accomplish certain goals. And we actually got a couple offers that we walked away from because there wasn't that alignment and it wasn't the right deal for us at that time. And it wasn't the right deal for the investor at that time either. And when we found those people who properly understood the water market, then suddenly the offers started to really align with the trajectory of the business for optimal growth.
Do you feel like you're, well, the fact that you're a female entrepreneur helped you, hurt you? You know, I've asked this to a number of people, and first of all, the women say, well, you should ask that to the men too. It's like, okay, all right. I'll be fair. And then some of the other ones say, well, I don't know. I mean, I have no other experience, you know? So I know that's kind of it's a weird question, but I also know that in the water business, like in every other business or many other businesses, they tend to be male centric. And there can be difficulty, as you, to use your word, you know, just by the fact of your gender. And so I'm curious, you know, I still haven't figured out how to ask that question or to broach that subject in an appropriate manner, but I'm getting there. So what's your experience, or, you know, what's your perception of that?
So I think, before I answer, I will say I, like you, am struggling on finding a PC way of answering this question. So forgive me if my answer is not fully PC. I have worked my entire life in male-dominated industries. I did sales to the oil and gas industry. You know, I'm currently selling to the mining sector. I never encountered sexism like I did in the investment process.
Really?
In any of those industries. Or, you know, like, it was there, but it didn't inhibit what I was doing. In the investment process, it was, I felt it present throughout. And there was many interactions where it was obvious, and many interactions where it was maybe not explicitly obvious. But, you know, when I looked at what I was doing compared to the other people who were getting up on stage and presenting, you know, I was going above and beyond. I felt, you know, my presentations were better. My answers were better. I had to be 10 times better or 100 times better than the competitors to even be playing at the same field. And that was just my experience. I hope that's not the experience that every woman has doing that, but it certainly was mine.
And so your method for overcoming that was just trying to be the best. I mean, you know, just trying to overachieve. I mean, was that the way that you kind of dealt with that?
It's the only way I know. Like, and when you go back and, you know, one of the things I did, it was go talk to my mother about it. You know, she ran a newsroom when women weren't really, you know, more than secretaries a lot of the time. You know, when she started out her career, she was actually dyslexic, and that was why she couldn't be a secretary. She said it was one of the best things that ever happened to her. And you know, her advice was, you know, if you have to be 10 times better, be 10 times better. That's, you know, are you going to quit? No. So I will exceed expectations. And all we can do to fix this problem going forward is have more and more women out there and people of color. I think they suffer that equally, if not like, I wouldn't want to be a woman of color trying to fundraise. Good heavens. But all we can do is succeed and change people's minds through experience, because it's such a subjective process. When you're talking about investing money in a startup and your only assurance is the people that you're meeting and your belief that they're going to perform for you, we can't remove sexism from that process, because it's just the slightest feeling of discomfort or distrust is going to have an impact.
Right.
So all we can do is perform until there's enough examples out there that people no longer see the difference.
Great. That was your answer was way better than the way I presented the question. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for saving me.
Oh, well, I'm glad it hit okay and didn't.
No, absolutely. I like your honesty. So that was great. Let's go back a little bit, you know, kind of to something, you know, less dangerous. what's your business model? Is it more like on cost plus? Is it, do you base your pricing on value to perceived value to the customer? How do you, because I've seen different companies say, hey, oh, my product's worth so much, we're going to charge this much. And it's like, well, I'm only spending this much on it now. I'm not going to spend that much on it, you know, with your thing, no matter how good it is. So how do you go about pricing what you do? Because there probably aren't very many other equivalent products. So there's nothing to compare it to.
Yeah. And I think you kind of nailed it there, which is that we can't really do an accurate cost comparison because I'm talking about people getting one data point every 2 weeks. That's very different than getting a data point every 5 minutes. No one's giving them a data point every 5 minutes. So I have to go in and say, you know, what do we think we're going to get from this? Like, let's together dream of what this data can do for us. And luckily there's other trailblazers in real-time data. So that conversation is becoming easier and easier. They know the value the data brings. As for our business model, I think that's somewhere we're definitely still learning as we move into the market. Our original aspiration was to be sensor as a service. I think we're seeing a lot more of those service-based models. We were originally looking at the municipal market. Capital expenses are much more difficult to secure than operational expenses. So for that market, it made a lot of sense. What we found is that business model, especially in hardware, requires a lot more capital upfront. And it increases the risk for the company significantly. If we have if our first model starts failing after 3 years and we still own all of them and responsible for all of them, we suddenly have a huge burden to go out and replace all of those. So in the early years, we're doing kind of a hybridized model where we are doing a purchase of the sensor with an ongoing data and support fee, which allows us to balance those two models. It gets us some of that benefit of the recurring revenue, which, you know, we do have ongoing data and support that we provide to our clients, so they get the value for that as well, while balancing that early stage cash requirements.
I'm curious as to why and how you have any conversational expertise in Japanese.
You did read my resume. Oh, no. I believe I started this interview by saying that I have had a habit of doing really, really difficult things. And Japanese was fun. It was fun and it was difficult. And that's my niche. I, in retrospect, I might, if I could redo everything in my life, I might have gone for a STEM degree. I probably would have had a lot of fun doing a STEM degree. I ended up going into arts, and I debated long and strong about what career what discipline I was going to take within arts. And after consulting a variety of adults with jobs, they told me it doesn't matter. You're getting an arts degree. Get whatever degree you want. No one cares. It's an arts degree. So I did what I wanted, which was Japanese. So yes, I do have some conversational ability in Japanese. It is less practical than you would think. But who knows? There's lots of companies serving the mining industry in Japan. So I may yet get a chance to use it.
I know that you're so when did you start 2S Water? How many years ago?
We started in late 2017, so about 5 years ago.
So what is, well, we talked about investors. Not only do you have to have a common goal, but, you know, they always have their end game in mind before they put their money up. So what's your end game? Where do you see this company going? Are you going to start it up, sell out, start another one? I mean, you know, it's you've already had a few of these. What's do you have you thought about the end game?
Yeah, well, and I think you can't take investor money without having clarity on what you want the end game to be, because again, that's a huge alignment point. You must both want the same thing, or you are not honoring the relationship you're establishing. And, you know, as I've said, I'm a student of business. I love business. I have done a few startups before, but this has been the first scalable one, and it's a lot of fun. I would like to play this game a few more rounds, and I can't play another round till I'm done this one. So added to that, that the 2S Water product really sits well in a portfolio of other sensor products. You know, we make sense to exit at some point. So that is the goal. You know, we're going to build this as big as we can to get to a relatively, you know, I don't want to say a quick exit. Nothing's quick in this industry, especially in water more than in startups. But the goal is to exit the company, to get our investors 10x or more, and to start another round of this game and play it out until I really learn and understand something about business that no one else does. And then when I get old, I'm gonna do the opposite of what your father did. I'm gonna go back and get a PhD in business and go be a teacher.
Yes, that's when I got. I was mid 20 years out of engineering school when I finally said, you know, I really need to get some letters after my name. So I went back and got my professional engineering license, and then I got a master's degree and was actually accepted into a PhD program. And my wife said, you know, we have two young kids. I don't really like you hanging out at universities, you know, with all of the young people. So why don't we just kind of cut that out right now? And I'm like, fine, I don't need a PhD. But I guess for me, and in my, I can't even call it a midlife crisis, I decided to start a podcast. So, you know, we all do different things, right?
Well, and yeah, like I do kind of agree with your wife in that a PhD doesn't really have any market value. So there's no point in doing it until my kids are a little older and you know, we've got our money in the bank, and then it'll just be a passion project.
That's exactly.
Then it'll be fun.
So what kind of advice would you give somebody who's considering starting a water focused startup company?
Well, you know, I love being a startup entrepreneur. So my first piece of advice is always, you should do it. You should go for it. But I think my second and maybe more applicable piece of advice is talk to people. Talk to people in the water industry. Like, people who have a startup idea are sometimes like, oh, it's my idea, I must protect the idea. No, go talk to people who are in the industry. Tell them frankly what your idea is, and they'll tell you whether or not they think they need it. When we had this original idea, we called up every water treatment in driving distance. And, you know, every time we call them, you get on the phone with the operator and they'd be like, hey, don't care who you are or what you're selling, I'm not buying it. And we'd say, no problem. Can we come see your water treatment facility? They'd be like, yeah, okay, for sure. Come out. I'll give you a tour. Yeah. And then we get an hour to talk to them. They'd teach us all about their water treatment facility. We'd teach them about the application. You know, by halfway through, they were like, I can see the applicability of that. By the end of the tour, they're going, can you go sell one upstream so that I get a notice when the water treatment plant, you know, 20K up the river gets hit? And then I'll have enough notice to make an operational change. So that was when we knew we had that product market fit, and when we went ahead with it. And we did all of that before we even incorporated the business and got a name down.
Right. You've started a lot of companies, but in this particular one, you know, what was the thing that surprised you the most, you know, starting 2S Water? Was there anything in particular that maybe you weren't aware of, or just surprised you, you know, about it all?
I think how it's going to sound silly because everyone warned me and everyone's warned every startup entrepreneur how long it took, how hard it is. Like, there's a lot. The first 4 years were all research and development. Just trying to get a product that would work in the field. Now we've got it working in the field. We're trying to get it to work better in the field, you know. And then we have to get into market. We have to get the scalability. We have to get, you know, there's a million factors in this. It is much more difficult than I originally anticipated. I mean, that works for me. That's lots of fun. I'm having a more fun than I ever have because I'm doing something more complicated than I ever have. But if that doesn't sound appealing, then starting a hard tech hard startup is probably not the way to go. Maybe start in software. Not that software isn't difficult, but that it's got much shorter cycles. You can run through these things faster. The learnings occur faster. And a lot of the really technical challenges around hardware development, there's nothing like them.
Right.
Now, having said that, I've been told by other entrepreneurs, because I sometimes walk up and down the hallways going, software, next time we're doing a software project. And other hardware entrepreneurs are like, no, once you've done hardware, you never go back. Hardware is like, just to hold a thing and to know that you've built it, that there's no replication for that. So so that's why I say do it. Start the business.
Okay, great. Well, this was such a fun conversation. I really appreciate the time and wish you all the best of luck. And we will revisit and have you on again when you start your next company.
That would be lovely. And thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure talking.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Astera with additional support from Imagine H2O. The producer is Anna Gagliardo. Theme music by Gabriella Gagliardo. Yes, this is a family affair. Your host is Paul Gagliardo. If you have any questions about this podcast or the series, please contact us at thewaterentrepreneur@gmail.com. And please follow us on Instagram. We hope to see you again next time. We'll be right back.